and gypsies' camps in some snug, sheltered nook, where old lane hedges like the pasture brook run crooking as they will by wood and dell.
Her song was full of joy, and she seemed to sing like a bird, from sheer happiness and freedom from care.
Vagabonds. That is it. I want to be a vagabond, a wanderer.
From Bizet's Carmen to Jackie King and Willie Nelson's The Gypsy, the figure of the gypsy has long inspired the artistic imagination. I'm Sally Plaxen. On today's What's the Word, Deborah Nord takes us to Victorian England for a look at the gypsy in poems by John Clare and Matthew Arnold. Catherine Grossman discusses Esmeralda in Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And Mary Burke explores the tinker figure in the work of Irish Revival writers, including William Butler Yeats. Join us on this edition of What's the Word? Gypsies.
It's very difficult to uncover readily the history of British gypsies because the gypsies themselves didn't leave behind a written record, and the accounts of gypsies that are either fictional or non-fictional tend to be filled with what we can only call myth and legend and lots of inaccuracies and fantasies.
Deborah Nord is a professor in the English department at Princeton University and author of Gypsies in the British Imagination, 1807 to 1930.
The English writers we have in the 19th century tended to have some knowledge of gypsies. Either they saw them in their towns or they saw them camped on the outskirts of town. They would see gypsies looking for work in the towns, either as metal workers or fortune tellers or performers of odd jobs. So that there was this kind of interesting familiarity with gypsies, and yet there was a strangeness about the gypsy because the gypsy was always out of reach.
This element of mystery, says Nord, fascinated Victorian England because it touched on questions of origins and identity.
The gypsies seemed to arrive in Western Europe, that is, in England, from India, at some point from India, in the 16th century. So they not only had been in England for a number of centuries before the Victorians got to the subject, but they also were, of course, mixed with the English. They were both exotic and sort of homely and domestic. And that suited many writers who were interested in looking at the gypsy almost as a kind of original English person, as a representative of an ancient time. The gypsies didn't seem to have changed over centuries. So that became a real focus of interest, particularly in writing that associated the gypsy with pastoral, that is, with rural life, with the countryside, with provincial life, and with a pre-modern England.
For instance, in the poetry of John Clare,
often referred to as the peasant poet, who wrote a good deal about rural life, about the English worker, the English peasant.
Clare wrote about gypsies in a number of poems, including The Shepherd's Calendar, composed in 1827. Nord reads,
"And gypsies' camps in some snug, sheltered nook, where old lane hedges like the pasture brook run crooking as they will, by wood and dell. In such lone spots these wild wood roamers dwell, on commons where no farmer's claims appear, nor tyrant justice rides to interfere." For Clare, the gypsy's camp represents both a place of safety, of the snug, sheltered nook, the place where the travails of life seem far away, but they also represent liberty, people who are unfettered, who, like the brook, go as they will. And he refers here to the laws as tyrant justice that try to interfere with the freedom of the gypsies, that prevent them from camping on public lands and try to somehow chase them off of the English landscape. But for Clare, there's a kind of celebration of the reality of gypsy life. Claire is an interesting case because there's a kind of immediacy to his description of the gypsies. That sort of mythic and fantastical aspect of gypsy life tends to be kept to a minimum in Claire's writing. There's almost a political edge to what he wants to say in phrases like tyrant justice, which he uses to indict the legal system in its relationship to gypsies.
The Scholar Gypsy, an 1853 poem by Matthew Arnold, also associates the gypsy with pre-industrial England, but adds another element.
Arnold, in this poem, addresses a mythic figure called the Scholar Gypsy. As the legend went, the Scholar Gypsy had been a student at Oxford who decided to drop out of the rat race, as it were, and to go and live among the gypsies in the countryside around Oxford. And as a result, this story went, the gypsy had become immortal. And so the speaker of the poem asks him how he's maintained his immortality and then cautions him about coming too close to the modern world. But fly our paths, our feverish contact fly, for strong the infection of our mental strife, which though it gives no bliss, yet spoils for rest. And we should win thee from thy own fair life, like us distracted, and like us unblessed. Soon, soon thy cheer would die, thy hopes grow timorous, and unfixed thy powers and thy clear aims be cross and shifting made. And then thy glad perennial youth would fade, fade, and grow old at last, and die like ours. So, what we see in thinking about the transition from Claire to Arnold is that Claire sees the gypsy as an immediate figure, as a real figure, as a figure subject to laws and legal persecution. Arnold actually focuses not on the gypsies themselves, who barely appear in the poem, but rather on this intermediate figure, the scholar gypsy figure, who has abandoned civilized life to live among the gypsies, and who is therefore idealized and romanticized by the poet, by the speaker, by Arnold, as someone who partakes of the best of both worlds. That is, he's an educated man, but he's also a man who has learned to live in nature.
In suggesting that modern life would contaminate the gypsy, Arnold reverses some contemporary beliefs about gypsies,
which viewed them as contaminants, as agents of contagion, that one would be foolish to expose oneself to.
By the end of the century, a group of folklorists founded the Gypsy Lore Society.
They used the myth of the gypsy to reject bourgeois constraints and bourgeois respectability in their own lives. And so what you see in the writing of some of them is a kind of disturbing projection onto the gypsies of what they think of as a kind of unfettered existence, sometimes an unfettered sexual existence, sometimes a wholesale rejection of modern life that in fact is a fantasy or a wish or desire of the gypsy lorists, the scholars themselves. So what begins in John Clare as a kind of strong identification with gypsies, an appreciation of their plight, also of their freedom, turns in Matthew Arnold to a kind of mystification of gypsy life. And then finally in the Gypsy Lorists in the 1880s, what I would call a projection, that is an imposition of a kind of identity onto the gypsy that suits the lorist's own needs. So by the turn of the century, this nostalgia for pre-industrial life that we see the gypsy representing really all through the century kind of hardens into caricature and stereotype.
In 1970, an English gypsy, Sylvester Gordon Boswell, published a memoir called The Book of Boswell.
He sees that the gypsy was prevented from living as he wanted through a series of legal persecutions, through harassment, that would appear and disappear and then reappear throughout the 19th century. But he also does something interesting. He embraces the necessity of change.
Mm-hmm. I'm Sally Plaxton, and you're listening to What's the Word, a program made possible through support from the Modern Language Association of America, an organization dedicated to encouraging the study of language and literature.
French gypsies in the 19th century were called Egyptians, but they probably came from Eastern Europe, and they were vagabonds, beggars. They were outcasts.
Catherine Grossman is the author of the early novels of Victor Hugo, Towards a Poetics of Harmony. She's a professor of French at Penn State University in University Park.
With the French Revolution and the onset of the Romantic era, interest in the gypsies expanded tremendously. My take on this is that 19th century France was obsessed with the notion of freedom, or liberté, and its effects. The notion of individual and collective freedom was highly desirable, but it was also something to be feared if it wasn't sufficiently contained. Peoples like the gypsies, who were socially unconstrained and rootless, would have embodied the idea of human freedom, both for better and for worse. So they became a symbol of what the French most desired and what they most feared.
Victor Hugo was born in 1802, 13 years after the French Revolution.
His mother was a royalist, his father a republican, and because of that he was very much a child of his age. He was also a literary prodigy, and by his late 20s he was an established novelist, playwright, and poet.
Nevertheless, in 1830 he was struggling with his book, called in French Notre-Dame de Paris, when revolution again broke out.
The novel was born amid great social unrest at a time when Hugo was attempting to stake his claim to glory with a new kind of popular historical fiction. His interest in gypsies clearly coalesced around several figures, and I think that his own literary stakes in becoming a famous writer were wrapped up in talking about their kind of freedom.
The book, called in English The Hunchback of Notre Dame, takes place in 1482, in late medieval Paris.
There are four men pursuing a beautiful gypsy dancer whose name is Esmeralda. One is a self-centered poet, Pierre Gringoire. Another, the archdeacon of Notre Dame Cathedral, Claude Frollo. His adopted son, Quasimodo, the hunchback of the title. And Captain Phoebus of the King's Archers, who loves beautiful women. Phoebus tries to seduce Esmeralda, and Frollo then stabs him and leaves Esmeralda to face justice in his place. Esmeralda is condemned to hang, and Quasimodo saves her. All of the other beggars with whom she lived storm Notre Dame to rescue her, and that's the great scene with the gypsies climbing all over the walls of Notre Dame. And in the meanwhile, Frollo steals Esmeralda and asks her to marry him or die. So she chooses to die. And at the end, Quasimodo throws Frollo off of Notre Dame Cathedral, thereby bringing divine justice to his crime.
For Hugo, says Grossman, Esmeralda represents the best qualities of human freedom.
She has an original way of singing and dancing. She's very kind-hearted. She's transcendently beautiful. She's all that is good. And so she's a figure of the possibilities of human freedom and, if you will, of the sublime.
Hugo writes,
"She was not tall, but seemed to be, so proudly erect did she hold her slender figure. Her skin was brown, but it was evident that by daylight it must have that lovely golden gleam peculiar to Spanish and Roman beauties. Her voice was like her dancing, like her beauty. It was charming and not to be defined, possessing a pure and sonorous quality, something ethereal and airy. Her song was full of joy, and she seemed to sing like a bird, from sheer happiness and freedom from care."
Esmeralda, whose freedom might have felt threatening to some readers, must die at the end.
At the beginning, she's the picture of youthful innocence and exuberance, but she becomes an image of female powerlessness and victimization, being accused of murder and witchcraft. She becomes terribly depressed in jail. It's heartrending. And of course, when she's hanged, she's the completely voiceless, powerless woman, a victim of her time.
The gypsies in Hugo's novel live in the Court of Miracles, not a real place on the map, but described by Hugo as the wings of the theater, which is Paris.
The vagabonds and beggars in the novel, who are basically the gypsies, symbolize or represent the grotesque, that is the dark side of freedom, which is extremely disordered. They hide in the Court of Miracles. It's their home base from whence they go out and basically pick the pockets of Paris. And when they go back, they mix and mingle in ways that seem almost obscene.
Hugo writes,
"Men, women, beasts, age, sex, health, disease, all seemed to be in common among these people. All was blended, mingled, confounded, superimposed. Each partook of all. It was like a new world, unknown, unheard of, deformed, creeping, swarming, fantastic."
Like these hordes, Esmeralda and Quasimodo are also outsiders, but with a history.
The deaf, lame, and half-blind Quasimodo is actually a gypsy child. He's only 20 in the novel, and he was exchanged at the age of 4 for the baby Esmeralda. In other words, he's her symbolic sibling, which is why their love affair will never work. The fact that he is a gypsy may help to explain why he's described in the book as a giant broken to pieces and badly cemented together, because he's as disharmonious and disorderly a creature as the gypsies are in relation to civil society. They're lawless, and his body is lawless.
Hugo's portrayal of the gypsies is sympathetic.
They're poor, they're ignorant, they have their unfair trials, but their lawlessness and their notion of fairness is no worse than that of French society as a whole. Esmeralda and Quasimodo both come up before judges in the medieval courts, and they experience the most extreme injustice in their sentences that one can imagine. So civil society itself is no better than gypsy society.
In some ways, says Grossman, Hugo identified with the gypsies as outsiders.
One of the great scenes in the novel is when the vagabonds attack the cathedral to liberate Esmeralda, and the king's henchman specifically says that the attack is not the end of the monarchy as they know it, but that someday the bells will ring and there will be enormous mobilization of the populace against the powers that be. It's very clear that he's talking about the storming of the Bastille 300 years later. So even though Victor Hugo was raised by a royalist mother and had some misgivings about unleashing the enormous energy of the people, he lived through a new revolution in 1830 that galvanized him to write his book, and that he understood to be an event similar to his attempts to storm the Bastille of the French neoclassical powers that ruled the literary tastes of the day.
I'm Sally Claxon, and you're listening to What's the Word? Gypsies.
The tinker figure was different to the gypsy figure in that the tinker was understood to be indigenous and was understood to be the carrier of lost folk ways, a lost oral culture.
Mary Burke is professor of Irish literature at the University of Connecticut at Storrs. She's written about the tinker figure in Irish literature in a variety of journals and essay collections.
The community now known as travellers was referred to by most house-dwelling Irish people and in most literature before the 1960s as tinkers. This term is considered pejorative by the community itself. So I'll stress that when I use the word tinker, I'm going to use it in reference to the literary image of the traveller. And it's a good way to distinguish between the reality and the fantasy of this figure, I think. Travelers don't consider themselves gypsies.
Travelers have probably existed on the edge of Irish society for centuries, says Burke, and are distinct from the rest of the Irish population.
They share common descent and have discrete cultural practices, early marriage, extended family groups, an aspiration to be mobile, an adaptive tradition of self-employment and involvements in trades or services that aren't generally pursued by the other Irish. They have their own oral culture, and of course they have their own language, which they call cant, which members of the community speak only amongst their own. For many generations, travellers provided services to the dominant society. Seasonal farm work, horse trading, hawking, entertainment, tinsmithing, functions that held a good degree of value in a society that was predominantly agricultural until about the mid-20th century. At present, there are approximately 1,700 travellers in Northern Ireland and approximately 24,000 travellers in the Republic of Ireland in the south. So overall, they're only 0.6% of the total population. So when we begin to discuss just how many literary texts were written about this tiny, tiny minority, you'll begin to see how culturally significant they are in Ireland.
The earliest official references to tinkers as a distinct nomadic class date back to 1835. Theories about their origins abound.
Writers in the early 20th century were generally attracted to the theory that tinkers descended from the noble tinsmithing castes of ancient Ireland or from pre-Celtic peoples. So, you know, tinkers as some kind of lingering survival of the very ancient Irish.
During the late 19th century, a literary period known as the Irish Revival got underway.
It was initiated and developed by writers such as Lady Gregory, William Butler Yeats, John Millington Synge in the 1890s and onwards, due to the perceived need to revive, resuscitate Irish culture and old Irish literature. This movement stimulated new appreciation of Irish traditions and encouraged the creation of works written in the spirit of Irish culture as distinct from English culture. So in other words, this cultural movement had a definite political agenda, given that Ireland was still in union with Britain at the time.
The tinkers also provided entertainment, and the image of the wandering tinker fiddler was popular with writers.
In fact, a nationalist writer named Robert Lind actually wrote in 1909 that the fiddle was, quote, one of the most patriotic instruments of the revival, and was one, moreover, that was very much associated with tinker characters in Irish writing at the time.
Tinkers were popular with revival writers looking for inspiration in Ireland's myths, legends, and folklore.
The depiction of them in folktales, of course, verged from suggesting they had supernatural powers to dismissing them as rogues. Overall, they were always outsiders, figures of mystery, in majority culture folktales.
Burke points to Yeats' 1902 play, Where There Is Nothing.
In this play, a rebellious, upper-class young man named Paul decides to reject the values of his rank and to run away with the tinkers. He eventually marries a tinker girl. So in the scene I will read, Paul's parents' friends, Mr. Dowler, Mr. Algy, Mr. Joyce, and Mr. Green, they all try to warn Paul that he is being foolish. Mr. Dowler, I suppose you have some picturesque idea about these people, but I assure you, you are quite wrong. They are nothing but poachers. Mr. Algy, they are nothing but thieves. Mr. Joyce, they are the worst class in the country. Paul, oh, I know that. They are quite lawless. That is what attracts me to them. I am going to be irresponsible. Mr. Green, one cannot escape from responsibility by joining a set of vagabonds. Paul, vagabonds. That is it. I want to be a vagabond, a wanderer. As I can't leap from cloud to cloud, I want to wander from road to road. That little path there by the clipped edge goes up to the high road. I want to go up that path and to walk along the high road and so on and on and on, and to know all kinds of people. Did you ever think that the roads are the only things that are endless, that one can walk on and on and on and never be stopped by a gate or a wall?
The tinker represented the kinds of values with which the urban middle class and upper middle class revival writers identified.
They were idealized as the carriers of artistic values, really. They were uninhibited. They were free. They were creative. And this is why you could almost say it's narcissistic on behalf of this writerly class to identify, or rather to recreate, tinkers in their own image in the revival. So the tinker is really the bohemian figure of Ireland. The word bohemian enfolds actual wandering people, nomadic peoples, and it also, of course, enfolds writers and artists. So the tinker was a kind of bohemian to the revival writers, with whom they, as fellow bohemians, identified. In reality, there was a chasm between how tinkers were perceived by rural dwellers and the manner in which they were depicted as romantic, unconventional free spirits in the work of predominantly urban writers, really, the writers of that period. In the revival writing, the tinker was a kind of monarch of nature, haughty, unbound by rules, innately artistic, a monarch of nature for whom the rural landscape was his or her own personal kingdom.
The revival era came to a close in the 1910s.
After the revival, and after the partition of Ireland into north and south in the 1920s, the tinker was a much less sympathetic character in the literature. It was often a one-dimensional figure of colour or ridicule in the comedies after partition. And the landless wanderer was also demonized in some of the writing of the era. This, I think, reflected the conservatism of the island as a whole after partition, in which values of land ownership were idealized hugely in the culture.
After the 1960s, the traveler replaced the tinker figure.
Traveler culture itself is increasingly literate and vocal in the late 20th century. And from about the 1970s and 1980s onwards, we begin to see the emergence of traveller memoirists, traveller writers. This is a historically non-literate culture. So this is the first time in history that a body of work by travellers themselves is becoming available. Traveller writers feel the need to address the literary image of the tinker in their writing, because the literary image of the tinker is very, very entwined with the understanding of what a traveller is in majority culture.
Thanks for joining us on What's the Word. I'm Sally Plaxen. Technical Director, Duke Marcos. Production Coordinator, Lee Morgan. Production Engineer, Steve Weiss. For a list of works mentioned on today's show, Gypsies, please email us at radio@mla.org and ask for a copy of the list for program number 251. That's radio@mla.org. Or call 646-576-5102. To listen to other programs in the series, visit our website, www.mla.org. Join us next time on What's the Word?